The Commentary Track, conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello and welcome to episode 38 of The Commentary Track. This show is not meant to be a substitute for professional mental counseling. It's not a doctor's office. It's more like a waiting room where people talk endlessly about movies. Talking endlessly about movies with Steve Stolyar today. Steve is the author of a really wonderful book called Raised Eyebrows, My Years Inside Groucho's House. And he talks about the years when he was in his early 20s and Groucho was on his way out. It was the last 3 years of Groucho's life. And Steve became a secretary to Groucho and also was put in charge of getting all of his memorabilia and scripts and stills and all that stuff in order to go to the Smithsonian upon Groucho's passing. What a life he lived with Groucho. It's really fascinating. The book is terrific. I read it years ago. I think it was published about 15 years ago. And only recently, this year, has it been republished in an updated and expanded edition. And I highly recommend it. Great fun, also kind of touching. It's a good book. Take it from me. If you are at all interested in Groucho, it's really something to read. Steve Stolyar is a terrific storyteller in his own right and does as good a Groucho imitation as anybody you'll ever hear, at least the old Groucho. I've never heard him do Groucho from Duck Soup era or anything, but I bet he could do that if he put his mind to it. Also does a really good S.J. Perelman impression, and you don't hear a lot of those. Christopher Walken, yes. S.J. Perelman, not so much. So I hope you'll enjoy this really fun interview with Steve Stolyar, and I'll see you on the other side.
My mom was a big movie buff, and she would often make a point of having me watch old movies on TV. My dad liked them, too. And then junior high, I remember there was a bank near our house in Tarzana that would show silent movies, and they had, like, Chester Conklin came there one time, and Rene Adderay, I think, and remember they had a hat that Chaney wore in Tell It to the Marines on display. So I sort of found it fascinating, and I always liked current movies, too. It wasn't that I was only lost in old sure. cinema. But I certainly, and I never made a point of learning about them, because when you love something, you absorb it because you want to. So I've never understood when people say, how do you know that? Or why do you know that? And it's like I'm supposed to say, on June 4th of 1971, I learned that the road pictures were Singapore, Zanzibar, Morocco, Utopia, Rio, Bali, and Hong Kong. And that's why I know that. It just seeps in. And if you're lucky, it'll stay without spilling out your ears. So I just soaked in all the stuff about old movies. And the thing about the Marx Brothers is I probably didn't really get into them seriously, which is an odd word to use about the Marx Brothers, till high school, but I had an Uncle Joe, who was my mother's brother, who was balding with gray hair, glasses, a mustache, and he smoked a cigar, and he used to raise or wiggle his eyebrows when he would say something funny. So there was something vaguely familiar when I would see the You Bet Your Life Groucho in syndication. It was just like Uncle Joe. But there was something about them. I mean, I love Laurel and Hardy. I very much like Abbott and Costello. I loved the Three Stooges when I was 7. But there was something about the Marx Brothers that was that blend of clever and physicality that I just thought was it was just such a winning blend of, you know, knockabout comedians and then this sophisticated New York literary stuff coming in through Groucho's mouth. That's the short answer to your question.
It's a podcast. You can be as long as you want. Yeah, I didn't even know about the Marx Brothers, I don't think, until I got to college. I knew about Groucho because I'd seen You Bet Your Life. But we lived in a small southern town with no TV reception to speak of. And so the number of old movies.
Farm Report.
Yeah, Hogbellies, we always knew what those were worth. But very rarely. We saw the Blondie movies, oddly enough.
I'm sorry.
But yeah. And we did see Laurel and Hardy and Our Gang and that kind of thing. But Marx Brothers, not until I got to college in Boston. And that was a great day when I think Duck Soup was the very first one I saw, which was astonishing.
Good and bad, because then it's sort of that was the pinnacle.
Yeah.
I think there's this magical trinity of Monkey Business, Horse Feathers, yep. and Duck Soup that is just like on this... On the putting green,
it sure is,
and it's like coconuts and animal crackers are wonderful, and have a lot of cool stuff. And being a purist, my friends and I feel that the worst Paramount is better than the best MGM.
Absolutely.
As much as we like Night at the Opera, there's a homogenization that happened at MGM, and it missed the looseness and the fun.
Yeah.
of the Paramount films, and they really were just, at their best, Monkey Business, Horse Feathers, Duck Soup, that magic trio.
I agree. They're wonderful. I remember, and we'll, this is going to the middle of the story before we hear the beginning of the story.
Well, you can edit
but,
that. And,
but I remember the first time I saw Animal Crackers. I think I was disappointed with it the first time. Every time the Marx Brothers weren't on screen, it seemed very dull to me. And it seemed as cinematic as Duck Soup and Horse Feathers are. Animal Cracker seemed very staid. But conversely, that's exactly what I treasure about it now, because it looks almost exactly like what you would have seen if you had gone to see that
right.
theater production.
It is stagey
yeah.
because it was a successful stage show. And because they didn't get the boom mic till
yeah.
Monkey Business, so they were, you know, in terms of the charm of the early sound films, it bugs me when old films are restored and then the people who do that fix the problems.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, I used to show people Animal Crackers to tell them about the stationary microphone. I mean, it sounds like a herd of buffalo coming down the steps at the beginning. And then when Zeppo would get there, as he would turn his head back and forth towards and away from the microphone, you would get, "I represent," and "who insists on my informing you, conditions under," comes here. Well, so they fixed that. So that's now all one volume, but it loses the, you know, archaeological value
sure.
of saying his voice sounds like that because it's planted in the...
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the real treasures to me of the early sound period, which I'm fascinated with, because they're always trying. There's something in almost every film in which they're trying something new or they're figuring something out, and it's just this great innovative period, and it gets a real short shrift, I think, from movie fans who find them all too something.
Well,
but
you know,
I love that period.
There's a case that some real purists make that film never quite recovered from sound. That it had become such a beautiful, smooth art form by 25, 6, 27, just with Sunrise and just so many beautifully shot films. And all of a sudden, people had to have their feet stapled to the floor and please speak into the flower pot. And it almost seems like if sound had come in long before or long after, we would have had more of this magic period of just beautiful pantomime photoplays.
Sure.
So, yeah, I could understand after, you know, seeing Keaton and Chaplin and all those people just flying all over the place in the silent films, all of a sudden they had to stand there and talk, and there was no guarantee that the movie was any good simply because it had sound. And there's a lot of just god-awful. That's another point I make to a lot of people, is that not every movie made before 1950 or 60 is a classic.
No.
There's some just... And conversely, there's some marvelous movies being made today. So I don't have that snobism of, they don't make good movies anymore. They're all terrible. Why do they have to... It's all special effect. It's like, you're not looking at the right ones. And I can show you some real clunkers from the 30s that show you that it wasn't all magic golden. Couldn't miss.
You know? I don't trust anybody who just gathers their little interest into a corral and that's all they like. You know, there's... I agree. We go to movies all the time. We go to new movies. We go to movies.
Yeah.
Just looking for the good ones. And, you know, in the early days, in the early sound days, I don't much care whether they're good or bad, because they're all interesting to me in some way, and they're all just another brick in the wall, I guess. It's just trying to piece together that what was happening in that period.
Well, you know the story about the orchestra and the coconuts.
No.
Because sound was new, they were going to shoot the first scene where there's the band playing at, what is it, a party or some gathering. And so the producer said, you have to dress up the orchestra in costumes and have them on camera, because otherwise the audience is going to wonder where the music is coming from. In a Broadway show, they know the orchestra's in the pit.
Yeah.
But if people are talking and all of a sudden you hear trumpets and violins, they're going to want to know where it's coming from. And someone, George Kaufman or someone, said, that's ridiculous. It's like, darling, there's something I need to tell you. Oh, what's that? And all of a sudden you hear a song and you sing. So they had to dress up all of the musicians. And in fact, in the first scene where you hear music, they weren't captured at all on camera. So all that was gone through. But it's all part of that sort of like savages hearing an airplane for the first time, that they wondered about, you know, going behind the screen to see where the musicians are, that sort of thing. And of course no one cared.
No.
But they didn't know what to worry about and wanted to try to guard against shocking the audience.
Every step of the way in developing the motion picture, there's been some fear about what audiences can and can't take. You know, in the very early days, really early, pre-1910, it was widely thought that you couldn't do a close-up because people would wonder, how is this head existing without a body on it?
And of course, people ducking from...
Yeah, which I'd never have believed and still don't, but...
I remember in a film class, I had heard that Griffith was told by the theater owners, don't show close-ups of hands and eyes and lips, because people are paying to see the whole actor, and we don't just want to see his arm or the tear go down his cheek. We want to see, like a play, you paid to see, there's all of that actor standing there.
Yeah. And when color starts being developed, you know, you see all this correspondence to the studios saying, can audiences stand to look at that much bright color for an entire feature film?
Especially when it was used, you know, for certain sequences like the finale or musical numbers like Rio Rita or something like that. I would think it would be more confusing that this black and white movie they've been watching for 70 minutes all of a sudden are in pastels wandering around and then going back to black and white sometimes.
But in fact, there'd been weird little inclusions of color all through the silence. Wings was restored a couple of years ago, and for the new Blu-ray, and they put in the Hans Liegel stuff, and so all the flames are yellow and red and all that stuff. And so audiences were perfectly aware of all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And I don't think audiences have ever been nearly as
we don't want to throw them. We don't want to confuse the crowd.
It's just
all
funny.
Robert Armstrong saying, wait a minute, they think you're trying to put something over on them with this music out of nowhere.
I have a great book somewhere around here called Introduction to the Photoplay, and it's a bunch of seminars done, I believe, at USC in 1928 and 29.
Wow.
And Irving Thalberg is there, and all these people from the studio are there, and these are exactly the sort of things they're talking about. They're talking about music in that very way. Will people understand if do we need to have somebody go over to a gramophone and put a needle on before the music starts, mm-hmm. so the audience will have some sort of context
about
what they're saying?
They wanted Groucho to wear a hair mustache and coconuts, and the excuse was, sure, on a stage you can have a grease paint mustache, but people aren't going to believe that's a mustache. And, and Groucho's point of view was, they laugh just as hard when I put the grease paint on stage after using an artificial one. And so it's like all these little battles that had to be fought that didn't really have to be fought, but just to satisfy the squeamish studio people and theater owners.
Yeah. And I guess it never ends. It just every new innovation comes along. There's somebody who's thinking, this will never work.
I know for a fact that F. Scott Fitzgerald is kicking himself that he didn't think of writing The Great Gatsby in 3D.
See, that was a big oversight on his part, I think.
How could he, a man of vision, and he missed that?
Just not enough vision, I say. So,
definitely.
He was distracted by Zelda.
Yeah.
Well, I'm intrigued by the whole Animal Crackers thing, and really intrigued in how it even occurred to you to start this petition to get the film released.
Well, being a Marx fanatic, after all, that is what fan is an abbreviation of, and I have no apologies. I was a fanatic. And, for our younger listeners, both of them,
mm-hmm.
You have to re-explain that you didn't have videotape or DVDs or TCM or streaming video or screaming video. And if you wanted to see a Marx Brothers movie, you looked through the TV guide each week, and if Horse Feathers was going to be on Channel 5 at 2:03, you just willed yourself to stay awake past Carson, past Tom Snyder, into that netherworld mm-hmm. of Cal Worthington car commercials, and you would just, it's like, all right, Lives of a Bengal Lancer is on from 12 to, all right, so I'll watch that, and then Horse Feathers would be on. And that's how we cross things off our list of, oh, good, it's finally going to be on. And somehow we were able to stay awake. You just said, I have to because it's on, and there was none of that nodding off stuff we know about now. But Animal Crackers was the missing link in there. They only made 13 movies.
Yeah.
Only half of which am I really, much of a fan of. But Animal Crackers, it wasn't a minor film. I knew that it was an important film in their cycle. It wasn't as though someone had misplaced the big store, and, well, we might as well find it just to have a complete set. Animal Crackers was, Groucho was Captain Spaulding, and Hooray for Captain Spaulding was his theme song that he carried over into the quiz show, and it was the four brothers before Zeppo left, and they're, young and running around, and so, but it was, I wasn't sure what the reason was until it was explained to me in a film class that when the Paramount films were sold to MCA, all the pre-49 films, Animal Crackers was one of them, but they didn't have the right to show it because due to, I guess, a clerical error, the copyright had expired. It wasn't renewed, so the rights had reverted back to the authors and composers of of the Broadway play. So George Kaufman, Maury Riskin, Burt Kalmar, and Harry Ruby. And so Universal just didn't give it a thought. They just thought, well, we're not going to spend money to clear the rights to this old black and white movie. We have all these other fine movies in the Paramount thing. And so it wasn't in the cycle of when you'd see that incongruous MCA TV thing. Always bugged me. MCA TV. And it wasn't one of those. And it hadn't been in theaters. There were snippets of the dialogue on that LP that had been issued of snippets of dialogue from the Marx Brothers movie that's narrated by Gary Owens. Mm-hmm. That is the finger of Chico Marx. Anyway, I heard that there was going to be a showing of Animal Crackers at a Revival House in Anaheim in December of 73, and all of my close friends were Marx Brothers fans, so we all understood what this was. And at the time, there was the first of many gas crises in America, and they were doing the thing where there were long lines and they had to do odd and even and that sort of thing. So people were conserving gasoline, but my friends realized that it was worth blowing a tank of gas to drive to Orange County to be able to see this long-lost masterpiece. So we all piled in and went down, and it was just the most god-awful bootleg print, just I don't know how many generations removed from a real print. Just blurry, bleary image. However, we were riveted watching this. It's like, oh my God, we're really seeing this as best we could. And afterwards, in my naivete, I thought, I wonder if Groucho knows that it's playing here in case he hasn't seen it in 25 years. And I knew that Groucho's phone number wasn't listed in the phone book, but I also knew from just browsing through the Beverly Hills phone book to see who was and wasn't in there, because sometimes it's startling when you hear about, like, Clark Gable was in the phone book, the Encino phone book, and rarely got prank calls because people didn't think it was the Clark Gable. Harry Ruby was in the Beverly Hills phone book. Again, in 1973,
wow.
Who's going to be harassing him such that he needs it? Didn't you write, I Want to Be Loved by You, Boop Boop A Doop? And, you know, please, you're the 12th call today, and I can't handle it. So
all those Three Little Words fans.
That's right. Oh, gosh. What were they again? So I gathered up all my nerve, and I called Harry Ruby, and a woman answered who said that she was Mr. Ruby's nurse, and he was taking a nap, so could she take down my name and number? And she would give him the message. If Harry Ruby had answered the phone, I don't think any of what happened after that would have happened to me, because there would have been no reason to take down my name and phone number. I was just this kid calling about it. And it was wonderful talking to Harry Ruby. It wasn't a lengthy call, but it's like, oh my God, this is Groucho's inner circle. This is one of his closest friends since the 20s. This is a guy who's knew them when, and all those Groucho letters and the Groucho letters to and from Harry Ruby. Oh, my God, oh, my God. And at the end, he said, I'll tell Groucho that I'll give him your message. And I thought, oh, my God, Harry Ruby's going to give Groucho Marx a message that I, Steve Stolier, knows where. And so New Year's Day of 1974, I got a phone call from a woman who identified herself as Erin Fleming. Now, I knew who Erin Fleming was because, being a Groucho fan, I had read every newspaper or magazine article that was coming out about him, and I knew from the cover of Esquire in 72 there was the two of them on the cover of that. I had also seen Groucho's one-man show in December 72 at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, and knew in my heart that that was the only chance I would ever get to see him alive, because he was old and in weak shape, and it was, you know, we got the best seats we could for $9.50 each. That was top dollar. Now I don't think you can park there for $9.50. Anyway, and I clapped so hard that night that my hands stung the next morning. But Erin was part of that. She sang duets with Groucho. So I knew full well when she said, "This is Erin Fleming," no further introduction was required. And that supplanted the most exciting phone call thing from the Harry Ruby phone call of a very few days earlier. And I thought she was calling to get information about the screening. Instead, she said, "Why are they showing that? It's illegal for them to be showing that. They don't have the right to show it." And I felt like I was being grilled on some law that I had broken when I hadn't done anything but go see it and report back. And then it turned into this conversation of where she said she and Groucho had been trying to get Universal to clear the rights and reissue Animal Crackers, but they didn't believe there was a sufficient audience to warrant going through all that. Again, I have to explain to Gen Xers and younger, when we're so used to things now being pulled out of vaults, and, you know, I have a multi-disc collection of Robert Benchley shorts, and I adore Benchley. I discovered him through Groucho, essentially. And I used to think, God, it would be great to have, like, a videotape just filled with Robert Benchley shorts, but, you know, it would require setting the machine every night and all this. Back in those days, Universal did not see the point in striking new prints and paying good money to do this. So she and Groucho were leaving to go see Sleeper, as a matter of fact, Woody Allen's movie. But she thought it might be a good idea. Maybe she could bring me with her to Sid Sheinberg's office at Universal, president, I guess, of Universal at the time, as a sort of exhibit A of this kid that would drive all the way to Orange County during the gas crisis to look at Animal Crackers. So we agreed we would get in touch again after the new school quarter started, and I was just doing handsprings after I hung up. I was, oh, my God. So in between the time that I got that call and talked to her again, my friends and I had come up with the idea of starting a petition drive, so it isn't just this one lone kook kid that says, "I want to see Animal Crackers," but a whole chorus of people saying, "Yes, of course we would love to see this." So when I was back at UCLA, my friends and I started the committee for the re-release of Animal Crackers, had to register in the dean's office as a, you know, there's all these tables down Bruin Walk for all of these end the war and gay rights and legalized marijuana. Gee, things have really changed in all these years. And then there's this table with these kids and clipboards with petitions, and it's all about trying to get a Marx Brothers movie. And people would stop, and it's like, what's the catch? That they'd say, do I need to be a registered voter? Is the government going to get a copy of this? Because this was, you know, during the Watergate days. Everyone was paranoid about, sure, I don't know who's going to get a copy of this. I'd get people who would say, you know, I would love to sign this. I've just made it a policy that I just won't sign any petitions. But we did get a great many signatures. And being in touch with Erin led to my meeting Groucho. And even that was done in stages so that I could savor. On one call with her, I said, "Can I ask you something? It's been on my mind. Some of the books I have say that Groucho was born in 1895, and some of them say 1890. Which is the correct date?" And she said, "Just a minute. Groucho, when were you born?"
"October 2nd, 1890.
I hear, it's like, oh my God, he'd been sitting next to her. I just heard his voice come through my telephone. So that was exciting. And then during one of the calls about setting up Animal Crackers campaign and all that, I just asked Erin how Groucho was doing. And she said, well, here, I'll let you talk to him.
Hello?
I said, oh, hi, Groucho. How are you doing?
How am I doing what?
How are you doing whatever you're doing?
I'm telephoning. What are you doing?
I said, I'm telephoning, too. Isn't it a small world?
Yes, it's quite a coincidence. All right, I'll let you speak with my secretary, Miss Fleming.
Like, oh, my God, I just was conversing with him, and I made an ass of myself. So that was exciting. And then before the day that he came to UCLA and we talked to reporters and all that, we did make arrangements for Erin and Groucho to come by the dorm I was staying at UCLA to pick up some copies of the Daily Bruin to give to their publicist because it had the story about our campaign. And we didn't tell anyone because we didn't want this crowd downstairs for which we were soundly and justifiably reviled when we went back and said, we just met Groucho Marx. And it was so strange to see this silver Mercedes pull over to the curb, and there's this older man with a beret and a graying white mustache and a blazer. It's like, oh my God. And I said, Groucho, I'm very happy to be meeting you after all this time. And he said, well, you should be. And Erin said, this is the young man who's trying to get Animal Crackers released. And Groucho said, did you get it? And I said, no, but we're working on it. And he said, you better or I'll fire you. And I said, I didn't realize I was working for you. How much am I being paid? And he said, a little less than nothing. So, and off they went, and I had met Groucho Marx. Oh. And then not long after that, there was we officially made arrangements for him to come and tell the press and all this. And I was so nervous, and there were hundreds and hundreds of students in addition to camera crews from the networks and reporters from papers and AP and UPI, and just the idea of sitting out side by side chatting with my hero, who I thought if I could only shake hands with him I could die a happy kid. And here we are sitting side by side, and he was there was still, when I had seen him at the Dorothy Chandler, it was like being hit in the chest with a sledgehammer, how old and frail he'd gotten. And I was angry at the press for having perpetuated the idea that good old Groucho at 80 or 82, just as sharp as ever, just the same old Groucho. And so that's what I was prepared for, essentially the host of You Bet Your Life, a little older. And so when I saw him at the Dorothy Chandler in his one-man show, I couldn't believe how far he had fallen. But then when I spent time with him at UCLA and then later in his employ, I found out that there was a lot of the original Groucho left. And there's a big difference sitting side by side with him or at the lunch table or something and having him twist puns and things like that. A difference in that and standing in front of 10,000 people with a spotlight on you on a stage. So it was just a dream come true to be sitting. It was literally a dream come true because I used to dream about meeting him, and then I would wake up, and as the image of Groucho would dissipate, I would just think, damn, shit. And it was, it's like one of the reporters said, Mr. Marx, what is the purpose of your appearance here today?
I expect to get lunch.
But besides that?
I may get dinner.
And what do you think of all these students and the way the younger generation has embraced the Marx Brothers?
Well, I'm flattered by it. Last October, at Halloween, three kids came to the door dressed as Groucho, Harpo, and Chico.
And I said, what did you give them? And he said, I sent for the police. So it was just marvelous. And then, in fact, Universal relented, and they agreed they would release it in L.A. and in New York, and if it was, it did halfway decent, they would consider letting it play in other cities. So I attended the re-premiere at the United Artists Westwood Theater, and that was, another in a series of astonishing experiences to see the fruit of my... I mean, to look up and see in plastic, not my name in plastic, but at least the Marx Brothers and Animal Crackers on a theater marquee. It wasn't all that long ago that I had gone to see that blurry, doopy print. And it ended up setting the house record at the UA Westwood. It broke the record that had been held by the French Connection. And so it went into wide release, and I'm often hearing from people who say, I saw that when I was in college in Minneapolis or in Chicago or in all these other places. And it's very gratifying. People will thank me. They'll say, thank you for it. And I'll say, you know, it was literally a labor of love. And it's very gratifying to see how matter-of-fact it is to see Animal Crackers now on TV or DVD or something. But at the time, it was this fight to get this film out. And then once it was out, it's like my dream came true. I met Groucho, I talked to Groucho, and I didn't want this amazing experience to go away, but I had served my purpose in bringing the film out.
Sure.
And in the summer of 74, I had two summer jobs that fell through, for which I will remain eternally grateful. And I thought, I have, because my dad is kind of hovering over me saying, I don't want you sitting on your fanny all summer. You find something, go down to Taco Bell and see if they need busboys. So I called Aaron and I said, is there anything at all remotely that you think I could be used for? And she said, well, actually, dear, I had started out as Groucho's secretary, and now I'm really his manager. So the fan mail has been piling up, and we need someone to help with that. And also, we need someone who's very familiar with the Marx Brothers to organize all of Groucho's memorabilia, which is going to be donated to the Smithsonian after he passes away. And so we're wondering... And it's like, I remember it being like a Tex Avery moment where I'm at the house before she hangs up the phone, but it wasn't quite like that. And I assumed that I would be working at some Wilshire Boulevard office building, and then maybe twice a month he'd come in to sign checks or something like that. She said, oh no, dear, you'll be working right inside Groucho's house. There's a room there that you can use for an office, and you can make your own hours.
Wow.
And
I want that job.
And they paid me. I should have paid them. And I started out working. I started out the first week working 6 days a week, and then figured, you know, good enough for God, I'll rest on Sunday. But then I'm sitting in our house in Tarzana on Sunday thinking, why am I sitting here? I could be at Groucho's house. And showered and dressed and went. And so it was 7 days a week initially because I just couldn't get enough of it. I remember my mom used to say she would love someday to take a bath in chocolate sauce. That to her was like the ultimate. And that's sort of how I felt, to be ankle deep. I mean, first of all, in his house, regardless of what else was in there, even if it was... You know, even if he had a print of the man with the golden helmet and dogs playing poker, it was Groucho's house, and there he was. But, oh my God, the photos of the brothers as children out of makeup with their families, scrapbooks filled with reviews from vaudeville, Broadway, radio, film, television, letters.
So you were basically cataloging this or just arranging it, labeling it?
Arranging. You know, I started out, I did it chronologically, and it was interesting that the scrapbooks had been methodically kept. Have I talked too long?
No.
Have been methodically, you say that now, kept from the earlier years by his wives. But then in the early, mid-60s, after You Bet Your Life went off the air, they got kind of sloppy in cutting things out and putting them in scrapbooks, which, you know, it really does parallel a lull in Groucho's career. He was semi-retired, and it was before the big renaissance where the baby boomers embraced the anarchy and all that. And so what there would be complete sections of the paper, and I would have to flip through to see that there was a mention of Groucho Marx will be appearing on the Dick Cavett Show. And so I had to arrange things first by decade and then by year and then chronologically within the year, and I would cut those out and filled up scrapbooks with all these miscellaneous things that no one had bothered to put in. There were scripts. There were versions of, I remember an early draft of Horse Feathers, and I think S.J. Perelman was the only name on it. And it was on Onion Skin pages. It was very different from the final version. And there wasn't an actual cataloging. I mean, I say that I was hired as a secretary and archivist, but I didn't know what I was doing. I had no training. I don't know the Dewey Decimal System, or, you know, I was essentially trying to give form and sense to something that had been anarchic, you know, appropriately sure. given the Marx Brothers. But so I made folders for each of the films, and so the stills would go in the folders for each of the films, and miscellaneous for family shots, miscellaneous 50s shots, 60s shots, the scripts, so that things could at least be gotten to if someone said, what photos do we have? Especially as certain books were being put together, the Groucho file and the reissue of Beds and the book on You Bet Your Life, The Secret Word is Groucho, all of those required photos, and so we started with what was already on hand before having to track something else down. And then getting ahead of things on the fan mail, she wasn't kidding when she said it had been getting out of control. They hadn't even been dealing with the fan mail for, I think, maybe a year or more, and drawers were just bursting with unopened letters, and I at least dealt with the ones where people sent photos of him for him to sign. Because, you know, in all the time I was there, which ended up being the last 3 years of his life, I never took it for granted or lost sight of the fact of what it's like to be a fan. And I know if I had sent something to someone and then never heard back, I mean, obviously, there's no guarantee when you send something to a celebrity that you'll ever see it again. But so I aimed to please as best I could with books and things that people had sent that still had return addresses or return postage or something. So getting out from under that was quite a task. But Groucho would sign pictures. If someone sent something specific, I would take it into him, and he would write, like, to John from Groucho. It was never anything more elaborate than that, but he would personalize those. But because of the sheer bulk of requests that came in, for, you know, I liked you in this and this, can I have your autograph, can I have a picture, can I have your autograph, we would print up a stack of 8x10 glossies, and I would put a chunk of those on Groucho's desk, and then with a black Sharpie, he would individually write Groucho on all of those photos, which in and of itself, I think he gets he gets big praise for. Because even at that time, a lot of signatures were secretarial or a rubber stamp, or people had fan mail services. And so as requests would come in and people didn't enclose anything, I would personalize them as best I could in his handwriting over his actual signature to Bobby, best wishes, and then the Groucho. I found out that I'm a better forger than I thought I was, because there's a week doesn't go by when I look on eBay and I'll see a hybrid stole your marks to Billy, best wishes from, and they'll have, of course, you know, certificate of authenticity, this has been authenticated, and da-da-da-da. And if I feel like it, I'll send them a message, and I get the whole spectrum from, oh my gosh, it must have been amazing to work for Groucho, I will thank you, I will pull the item, to I thank you, I'll adjust the price down accordingly, to not hearing anything at all, or essentially, well, that's your word. and then, you know, sure. I can't stop them from selling a forgery. But I did once say to, you know, I was leaving his office bedroom, and I turned around and I said, on behalf of all of the fans that you sign pictures for, thank you, because I really think it's great that you take the time to do this. And he said, I consider it a part of my job, which I think is kind of charming.
It is. It's great. How often did you have to consult with him as you were cataloging things? Were there things that you couldn't identify that you would take into him? And
sometimes. Sort of it was particularly frequent when Hector Arce, who was Groucho's biographer and wrote some other Hollywood themed books, he and Groucho were putting together the Groucho file, Groucho Phile. And that was essentially a coffee table book of nothing but photographs from beginning to end chronologically, and then Groucho would supply the captions in terms of the information. You know, we would show him a picture, and he would say, you know,
she was married to the fowl that,
so we could, you know, so we put in that, in that firsthand information. But there were times when Hector and I, he would say, who is this, Steve? And I'd say, it's not Tony Martin. I don't know. And we'd go in, and one time was quite startling. We had gotten a photostat of Groucho's birth certificate so that we could establish he had been born October 2nd, 1890. And it said, number of children, or number of siblings, total, 3. Number of previous siblings, 3. And I thought it was a mistake, because I thought the oldest was Chico, then Harpo, then Groucho. So that would have been 3. But how could the previous be 3 and present be 3? And Hector, we just kind of looked at each other like, you know, they must have made a mistake. When we thought, we might as well find out. So we go into Groucho's room and asked him about it. I said, did you have any brothers before Chico and Harpo? And he said, yes, Manfred. Manfred would have been the oldest. But he got sick and died when he was just a baby. And I said, what did he die of? And he said, old age. But he would have been, we'll never know what Manfred's gifts would have been.
No.
Now, since then, I've run into people who've said, oh yeah, I knew about Manfred. Well, okay, and that's altogether possible. But Aaron Fleming didn't know about Manfred, and none of the people in Groucho's circle that I shared that with said, oh yeah, there was that kid that died in infancy. But so now, you know, when people will say, how many Marx Brothers were there, I end up kind of having to gauge the latitude and longitude of their question, because the answer is either 3, 4, 5, or 6. Take your pick.
Now,
I'm fascinated by the kind of people you were meeting when you were working over there, because I mean you met people he had written with. Nat Perrin, didn't you meet him?
Nat Perrin was wonderful.
Nunnally Johnson and people like that. It's
Nat Perrin, Nunnally Johnson, Maury Riskind, Irving Brecker, S.J. Perelman.
Wow. I'd give anything I own to have met S.J. Perelman.
Well.
Too late.
And I, you know, I had heard that there was acrimony between Groucho and Perelman, and which I think boiled down to Groucho being resentful that some writers said Perelman created the Groucho persona when it was pretty established by the time Monkey Business came around. Then Perelman bristled when people would say, oh, wow, what was it like writing for the Marx Brothers? Because he was one of the premier literary humorists of the 20th century. He filled, I don't know, maybe 20 books of short pieces that he had written for The New Yorker and other magazines. He won an Oscar for co-writing the script to Around the World in 80 Days, and he co-wrote One Touch of Venus for Broadway. And people would say, what was Groucho like? Oh, yeah, was Harpo, could Harpo talk? And so, you know, he was quoted in some interviews as saying, I am bored to tears with the subject of the Marx Brothers. By the way, that's what he sounded like. You'll have to take my word for it. So I heard that he was going to be coming by on his way back from one of his many Round the World tours. And Erin asked me if I want... She said, don't you want to meet Sid? And I said, but I've got a T-shirt and blue jeans and my old tennis shoes. And she said, oh, Sid won't mind. Just, you know, stick around. So I waited beyond the point where I would have left for the day. Perelman arrives with his entourage. He is impeccably dressed in a tailor-made three-piece suit and shiny shoes. He's with some woman who's got a full-length mink and a diamond necklace and diamond bracelet. He was with Andrew Duggan, the character actor, who also was in a suit, and his wife was also in a beautiful gown. And there I am in tennis shoes saying, it's such an honor to meet you, Mr. Perelman. And I'd already heard that he was sort of a misanthrope who had, he did not suffer fools gladly. And I thought, how could I possibly prove to him that, I'm so thrilled to meet you that I didn't even change my shoes. So I just sort of stayed a fly on the wall for that one, observing. It was interesting because after dinner, Perelman said, Groucho, do you mind if I smoke? And Groucho said, I don't care if you burn. And Perelman said, that was good, Groucho. Now let's try it for timing. And I thought, wow, it's like being on the set of Monkey Business. So then they adjourned to the living room, and I just kind of hovered with a... And I heard some of the people trying to figure out what were some of Perelman's jokes in the Marx Brothers movies. And I heard one woman say, shot an elephant in my pajamas. That was yours, wasn't it, Sid? No, I didn't write that. And someone else said, oh, vaccinated with a phonograph needle. You must have written that. Vaccinated with... No, that was someone else. And I said, the professor is waxing wroth. And he turned his head and he smiled and he said, yes, that was one of mine. And everyone's like, this kid, why does he know that? So not long after that, I went back to my office in the house to do some stuff, and Perelman excused himself from the group of people to take a leak. So he went walking down the hallway, and on his way back, I said, excuse me, but Groucho has this early draft of Horse Feathers that you wrote. Have you seen this lately? And I handed it to him. And he started thumbing through it and smiling, and he hadn't seen it. So then he was asking questions about me and who I was. And he said, you know, what is it that you hope to do? I said, I hope to be a writer, probably for television. And he said, my advice to you would be to write for the theater, because the theater is the writer's medium. Film is predominantly the director and television producers, but you get more control. And I'm thinking, I don't believe this. And then I mentioned about how Groucho had turned me onto the Algonquin Roundtable, lending me books. It's like he had all these marvelous books that were inscribed to him by Benchley and Wolcott and all. Wow. And I would say, can I borrow this? And he'd say, you can borrow any of the books that I have that you want to borrow. Just be sure to bring them back. So I mentioned Robert Benchley and Perelman Smith. He said, oh, yes, Bob was a great friend of mine, a wonderful. And I said, one of my favorite pieces that he wrote was about a Christmas spectacle where everything goes wrong and Mr. Murney comes out with an obvious pillow stuck under it. And, oh, yes, Mr. Murney was, he frequently would use Mr. Murney as a character name. And about 20 minutes elapsed, and I'm engaging him in conversation. I'm 20 or 21. And I start to hear, where's Sid? What happened to Sid? I don't know. Was he feeling all right? We better. And it's like, where was Sid? He was standing in Steve's office talking to him about the Algonquin Roundtable. And so I said, if I have one of your books, would it be possible to have you sign it while you're still here? And he said that he was staying at the Chateau Marmont and that I should bring it by and leave it at the desk, and he would be happy to. So I went out and bought a copy of his latest book, Vinegar Puss.
Mm-hmm.
And I took it to the desk and probably too loudly said, this is for Mr. Perelman. He's waiting for it. And then I left. And the next day I phoned the desk and they said, yes, we have your package here for you. I was like, oh, my God. My God. So I drove over there and I tear the paper bag off and I open it up and it says, for Steve Stolyar, with very cordial wishes for his ultimate success as a writer, S.J. Perelman, October 1975.
Wow.
And I thought, well, I can't become a plumber now because people would say, Steve, why does this say this? So, yes, he was one of a galaxy of remarkable people that I met. Nunnally Johnson didn't come to the house because he had emphysema, but we went to see him a couple times when I was there, and he was just a wonderful, he was from Georgia, and sure, the Southern hospitality that he and his wife Doris, his wife was the former Doris Bowden, who's in Drums Along the Mohawk and Grapes of Wrath, the latter being a Nunnally Johnson screenplay.
Sure.
And she was just this gracious, they were just two down-to-earth people. And I remember it was strange because Nunnally's mind was completely intact, but he couldn't walk across a room without being winded. And Groucho was in good physical shape, but his mind was getting hazy. And so I would watch the two of them thinking, which is preferable? I don't know. And Nunnally asked, you know, what I was interested in, and I said, you know, screenwriting. And at the time, Towering Inferno had come out, which was, it was, you know, after Poseidon Adventure, it really set the tone for all the disaster movies, sure, that followed. And it made a lot of money, and it was, I think it was a joint venture of 20th Century Fox and Warner Brothers. And Nunnally actually said, tell me, Steve, does a little picture still have a chance in this town, or does it have to be one of those two studio jobs? And I'm thinking, Nunnally Johnson is asking for my assessment of the state of Hollywood. And I said, well, I think if it's a quality film, you know, like The Graduate or Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, it can, you know, if it's a small film, it can do well. So I thought I sort of acquitted myself admirably there. But yeah, being at Groucho's house, even if people didn't know who I was, and there's sort of no reason why they would, I was treated with courtesy. And I think they must have figured if he's in the house, he must be okay. He could be Groucho's grandson. I don't know who he is. But no one had any kind of an attitude or snubbing thing except Barbara Streisand.
Hmm.
I know that flies in the face of her reputation as being a warm, cordial, sure, gracious hostess. But apart from her, certainly all of Groucho's old friends, there was something I noticed, that Aaron's coterie of younger actors and personalities were the ones that were kind of strange and weird and had attitudes, but Groucho's friends, who had had success for a while and were comfortable with it, were extremely personable. And so, I mean, God, George Burns. This is before the Sunshine Boys.
I was going to ask you about George Burns, because he's another idol of mine.
Well, his whole renaissance started with the Sunshine Boys.
Sure.
When Jack Benny died when it was in pre-production, and the role went to Benny's best friend, Burns, and that started. But even though that hadn't happened yet, I certainly knew full well who George Burns was and what he had done, and I found an original still of him and Gracie from a 1934 Paramount film called Many Happy Returns, Sepia, and I tucked it away there just in case. And so I was nervous when he was showing up, because, for heaven's sake, it's George Burns. And I opened the door, and he just breezed in and said, "Hi, you want to live a long time? Become an actor. You'll live to be an old man like Groucho and me. Okay, let's eat." And off he shuffled into the dining room, and we sat there. And the two of them, it would have reminded me of the Sunshine Boys had it existed as a film then, but I hadn't seen it. But the two of them would talk about the old days, and by the old days, I mean vaudeville. And Groucho would say, like, "You remember B.F. Keith's theater in Duluth? Because there was that drugstore that had the guy's daughter." "Now, that wasn't Duluth, Groucho. That was in Muncie, because the fellow that had the department store was..." And it's like, I don't believe this. And after we ate, Burns took a cigar out and fitted it into his little plastic holder and lit it up, and he said, "I never smoke expensive cigars. All I care about is if it fits the holder. Milton Berle pays $2 a piece for his cigars. If I paid that much for a cigar, I'd go to bed with it before I smoked it." And I had him sign my photo for Many Happy Returns. I mentioned having recently seen International House. And he told me about, he said, "I gave Fields a gag that he used in the picture." And it was something about a coffee cup. I haven't seen it lately. I saw it about
a month ago. Yeah.
There's some gag that involves a coffee cup with Fields in that. And he said, "Yeah, I gave him that gag and he used it in the picture." So, yeah, and Bob Hope came there. Wow. On his Groucho's 85th birthday. And he was in a tuxedo, and I found out it was because after Groucho's birthday party, he was going to a testimonial dinner for Danny Thomas. So, because no one else there was in a tuxedo. And he showed up, and Groucho had been singing and stopped and said, "This is a man who's made me laugh." And Hope said, "Oh, Groucho, you don't have to say that." And he said, "I wouldn't say it if you weren't here." And Hope just said, "This has been going on for 40 years. I just could never top this guy." So then I thought, this is going to be great. He's going to be telling Groucho stories. And he starts in saying, "You know, that Danny Thomas, he's so religious, he has stained glass bifocals." And we realized he was trying out his material. his Danny Thomas, but it's like you're in Groucho Marx's house. You've known each other forever, and you're trying out your... But, you know, it was still great, and it was still a remarkable thing to see. But in terms of the listening to George Burns and Bob Hope and Groucho talk about the old days, I, you know, having been a history major and being an archaeology buff and having a real sense of this has been this many years since this and this has been, I came to appreciate Groucho on three different levels. On the most obvious level, this is Groucho Marx. This is the guy that I saw in Duck Soup and Monkey Business, and You Bet Your Life. This is actually him. Then the next level was, this is someone who personally knew W.C. Fields and George Kaufman and James Thurber and George Gershwin. I mean, these people that are such mythic names.
Sure.
And he knew them well. I mean, he would talk about going to a party at Gershwin's house. And then the third level was, this is a man from 1890. This is a man whose firsthand memories start before the Wright brothers and go past the moon landing.
Yeah.
That's a staggering chunk of history to have witnessed. And I asked him once, I said, how far back can you remember? And he said,
I guess the Spanish-American War.
It was 1898.
Wow.
The brothers started out as a singing act, and as a matter of fact, Groucho sang at a benefit for the victims of the San Francisco earthquake of 1906. I think Caruso was on the bill the same time.
Yeah.
So just what he witnessed, in addition to, oh, and by the way, it's Groucho Marx.
Sure.
I just appreciated that from so many different angles.
Did you ever try to do any sort of a formal interview with him, or did you just engage him in conversation?
It was mostly engaging him in conversation.
Did you write things down, or did you just try to...
Well, many's the time he would, you know, despite the strokes and age and all that, the mechanism that was Groucho was still there. And I said before that, you know, in the relaxed atmosphere of his living room or the lunch table, it came a lot more easily than with a spotlight on him in front of, you know, thousands of people. And so, I mean, I took him to a doctor's appointment once, and that was a place that had an elevator operator. And the elevator operator said, you know, kind of unctuously, "Good morning, Mr. Marx. You're looking much better." And Groucho said,
"Thanks, I wish I could say the same for you."
And I know one Christmas he got a tin of candied almonds from Portland Allen, who was Fred Allen's widow. And Groucho was about to leave to go somewhere, and I said, "You got this is from Portland Allen." And he said,
"Send her one of my Christmas cards."
I said, "Don't you want to say anything special, anything personal?" And he thought for a moment, and he said, "Well,
tell her thanks for the nuts. Hope you're the same."
Which I thought was just delightful. And he always, even though he wasn't that involved in show business anymore, he loved keeping up with it. So he loved getting the trade papers, Variety and the Hollywood Reporter. So each day he would read to see what people were up to. And so one day he came to the lunch table and he said,
"Wonderful mail you brought me. Nothing but requests for money."
And I said, "But you got a Variety, didn't you?"
"Yes, a Variety of requests for money."
And it was so gratifying, and I hadn't realized I had handed him such an obvious straight line, but it was very heartwarming when he would twist it and hand it back to you, just as he would have phrased it at any point in his career, just a little more slowly. So when he would say things at the table, after lunch, I would go back to my office and scribble down what I remembered of what he said. And I still have this clump of scraps of paper some in pencil, some in pen, and a big rusty paper clip that has them clipped together, and I put them in the book. We haven't. It's astonishing that we've gone this long without me mentioning the book that I wrote, because I have no sense of business or plugging or anything like that. So here we are,
we'll
4 hours into our conversation, and I haven't mentioned Raised Eyebrows, My Years Inside Groucho's House, available on Amazon in Kindle form, and even an audiobook read by, big surprise, me.
I considered just using that instead of having you come over and do the interview.
Just plug me in.
Sure.
It's 11 hours and 38 minutes. So
see, that would have given me a multi-part podcast.
You could have taken a vacation and less come back and me. Said, well, thank you, Steve. So I did put those things in my book, the things I had scribbled down. Some of them were times when an interviewer would be sent from a paper or magazine to interview Groucho, and some of the best stuff he said was critical of them, which of course never made it into their interviews. Particularly as he approached 85, people like those round number birthdays. It's like no one's going to make a point of him turning 84 or 86, but it's like, oh, he's going to be 85, we should interview him. And so people were sent there, and some part of me realized that they're not all going to be Marx Brothers fans. It's just an assignment. But it was still awfully frustrating when I would hear them asking just the most basic questions, and I would think, you have a few minutes to talk to Groucho Marx. You ought to know this, or why are you asking him this? And at one time, he even sang a song for one of the interviewers, and afterwards the interviewer said, well, that was very good. Where did you learn to sing? And Groucho said, I've been singing all my life. Where did you learn to write? Well, maybe you haven't. And another, I think it was another interviewer said, So, what are you doing with your time? I'm wasting it talking to you. It's just so wonderful, you know. It's and gee, what a surprise it didn't make it into the interview. So it was fun to write these things down. I remember before in the Emmy Awards in 75, he was going to be presenting, I think, Best Comedy, and he and Lucille Ball were going to do it. And the poor producer came over to the rundown with Groucho to make sure things were set. And so the guy said, we're going to have to keep this fairly tight. And he said, I know Lucy will be. And he said, and remember, we're doing this live.
You're doing it live?
Yes.
Well, then you'll have to get someone else.
And they said, I don't know. He just gave the it was perfect, though, but he just gave this guy, I have that in the book as well, that I had written down the dialogue that would have been lost to the ages had I not gone and ran off down the hall and scribbled it down.
I know she will be.
And in fact, she was smashed and ignored him and wouldn't let him read any of the nominees or the winner, so he just stood there, which made it look ridiculous.
Wow.
And she got a lot of flack for that, and she said something like, before the show, she had been informed that one of her kids was in an accident, so she was rattled by that. But I think that turned out not to be the case, and she just had been... And someone had sent a letter to her and CC'd Groucho on it, and it said something like, Miss Ball, if you learn to stand on your head and spit wooden nickels, I wouldn't spend dime one to see you. P.S. Groucho, you are immortal. God bless you, or something like that. So it was interesting.
Now, I don't want this to go away without asking about the most important Marx Brothers, Zeppo. Didn't you meet Zeppo?
I met Zeppo and I met Gummo, the two extant of the 3, 4, 5, or 6 Marx Brothers.
Because Groucho always said that Zeppo was the funniest one of them all, and I wondered how he
Zeppo seemed decades younger than he was. He was 74, and he seemed to be like in his late 50s. He was tan. He lived in Palm Springs. He had great zest, and he really lit up a room when he walked into it. And people, they find it hard to believe because they only see him in those few Paramount films. And really, you know, except for Monkey Business and Horse Feathers, all he does is sort of introduce Groucho or say yes sir or something like that. But he really did. He had a great sense of humor, and he was a character. And I think he was, I suspect, a bit of what Chico must have been like, because Zeppo was interested in the ladies, and he was quite a card player. And he really did light up a room. And I happened to have been at the house. I brought the young lady that I was dating at the time, because that afternoon Aaron had said, you're going to stay here to meet Zeppo, aren't you? And I said, I have a date. And she said, bring her. And I thought, yeah, because the girl I was dating, nothing fazed her. And I thought, all right. And I picked her up, and I'm driving down Sunset, and she said, where are we going? And I said, a little out-of-the-way place. And I turn on Hillcrest, and she said, I don't want to do this. And I thought, that's too bad. And so Zeppa was smitten with her. She had blonde hair and blue eyes and was very bright, and he just kind of hovered. And when she and I broke up, I sent him a letter saying, essentially, you know, you've been around the track a few times. Do you have any advice for the lovelorn? And instead of giving me advice, he phoned me. And I was completely startled, you know. Steve is Zeppo Marx. Listen, do you think Linda would go out with me? And listen, I don't want to step on your toes. And if this is at all awkward, I would understand. And I said, well, she got a kick out of you. And you know, really, if this is at all uncomfortable for you. And so
and she was what, 22?
She was 19. Ah. I was 20, and he was 74.
Okay.
So it was a May.
It seems reasonable.
May, December of the following year relationship. So they only went out once. He said, I took her to dinner in San Diego and then to a Hialeah game in Tijuana. And he said, but I didn't even kiss her goodnight, Steve. I want you to know that. And he said, she's very nice, but all she did was talk about herself. And then when I saw her on campus, she essentially said, I really like Zeppo, but all he did was talk about himself. And I think they were probably both right. But at that dinner, you know, he said, well, you and Linda ought to come down and visit me sometime. And I said, I don't know. I was in Palm Springs. My parents took me to Palm Springs when I was about 8, and it was just sweltering. And he said, well, when were you there? In the summer? And I said, yes. And he said, well, Steve, it's cold in Alaska during the winter, too.
So you never went?
I never went. I should have.
Well, you should have. Well, since we probably should wrap this up in the next hour or so, let me cut to the end of the story, which is when Groucho passes away, did your job just stop? I mean, you were cataloging material.
My job as an archivist and fan mail handler. I mean, there were also letters that Groucho would dictate, and that was great fun. Type them up, and he'd sign them. When you know his end was really kind of a slow decrescendo, a series of health setbacks, minor strokes, and then falling and breaking his hip, and being confined to a wheelchair, and he's getting hazier and all this, and so. This coincided with this battle over control of Groucho between Aaron Fleming and Arthur Marx, Groucho's son, with whom he had had an up-and-down relationship even before Aaron was on the scene. So it was like, it's hard to know who to root for, because she was an extremely difficult woman that would scream at Groucho, and I think she just didn't accept his mortality, and she thought if she could scream loud enough, it would shake the rust off of his brain, and it was a, you know, it was a form of elder abuse, and that was not cool, but he had grown dependent on her. And then Arthur had been sort of persona non grata for a few years, and so I wasn't necessarily rooting for him, because I didn't know how he would take care of Groucho, and there were rumors that he would have put him in a home, da-da-da-da-da. So during this conservatorship battle, the judge appointed an interim conservator, and it was Nat Perrin, which both sides thought was a good neutral choice. And I thought, well, so that's it for me. I mean, this guy who's essentially on his deathbed doesn't need people to handle fan mail. And I get a call from Nat Perrin, and he says, Steve, will you... By the way, this is a dead-on Nat Perrin. Steve, it would help me out if you could stay at the house on weekends and sort of referee the two different factions and arrange for Groucho when Groucho's friends would come over and the author and it, so that they, you know, they don't bump into each other. And so it's like my most important job in all that time was one that Groucho really wasn't aware of, because he was in and out of the hospital and he was used to seeing me there, but he didn't realize that I was there like as a referee or traffic cop to keep those two factions from bumping into each other. And that was rough, because Erin, I mean, she sort of turned into Cruella de Vil, and to her, I was this servant who's telling her what to do. So that was my final role there, was actually a very important one, but I'd, you know, gotten away from what I'd been hired for, because that was a moot point at that point. And that's what I was doing up to and just past when he died. The last weekend I spent there was the weekend he died. I think he died on a Thursday, and so I talked to Nat again, figuring he's going to say, you know, never mind, you're not needed. And he said it would help if you were there to take the phone call. And I spent that weekend fielding phone calls from all these people who didn't know what was going on, because Erin didn't have. There was no funeral. Erin had a few friends over. Arthur had a few friends over, but there was no memorial or anything like that. And people were calling. And I remember Betty Comden called, and she said, is Erin there? And I said, no. Is Arthur there? No. And a pause, and she said, I don't know who to console. And I said, I guess we should console ourselves. Which I guess was true. I wasn't trying to be, you know, a sage, but it was sort of a common sense answer. So, that was, you know, and that was my last weekend there. But it was an extraordinary run, best of times, worst of times, but overwhelmingly positive. And I wouldn't trade it for nothing.
Well, I tell you, I am deeply envious of that experience of yours. Deeply.
I love getting messages from people saying, I hate you. And then I'll read beyond that, and it's like, you had the job I would have loved, or I would. Because it's like, as I say, I always kept one foot on the outside and could never stop appreciating what a lucky bastard I was. Even to the point of sometimes when I always ate at the lunch table with Groucho. It was a very democratic place. It wasn't like the help ate in the kitchen. But sometimes I would get a sandwich or a snack or something and sit at the kitchen table, and there was this window and there was lattice work out in front of the window on the outside, which didn't give you a sharp view of the kitchen. And so the vans of tourists would stop and at the driveway, and you know, the final Groucho Marx of the famous Marx Brothers for 1950. And sometimes I would wave, and I figured let them snap their Instamatics and go back to Duluth and say, I think Groucho Marx waved at me. I can't be sure, but I think maybe it was him. Because I knew what it was like to be sitting in that van thinking maybe he'll come get the mail or the newspaper.
Well, that was very nice of you. So a shadowy figure waved at them. And,
mm-hmm. And I remain a shadowy figure.
I was going to mention that. I was going to turn the light back on. So I really appreciate your coming over and doing this. This has been great fun for me.
My pleasure.
I've just been sitting here giggling the whole time. So,
and then I started talking.
Yeah, then you did, and I went into a stony silence.
Uh-huh.
So we're going to have to do this again sometime because you've got a lot more career to talk about. You're not just Groucho's guy. You've got other stuff to talk about. So you'll come back someday, and we'll do part two.
It's a deal.
Thanks, Steve.
My pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that talk with Steve Stolyar, and I hope you'll check out his book, Raised Eyebrows. It's available through Amazon, and if you want to buy it, and you will, because once you've listened to this, how can you not want to buy the book? Just try the link through my website, thecommentarytrack.com. There's a page for Steve Stolyar. You'll see an Amazon link to the book, and when you buy it, Steve will make a sale. I will get a little bit of a kickback. Amazon will make a sale. The publisher will be happy. All God's children will be happy. It'll be a fun, wonderful time where joy abounds. So please consider doing that. And for all your shopping needs, go through Amazon through my website. I have links to specific things, my own books, my own videos, the videos and books of all of the guests I've had, and there have been many of them so far. We're heading toward 40. It's just a great place to get everything, and it's a great way to help support the podcast without spending an extra penny that you would have anyway. So I appreciate that. A way you can also support the podcast by not spending any money is by going on iTunes and leaving a nice review and a 5-star rating. A lot of people have been doing that, and I've got some very, very flattering and pleasant reviews from people, and it just tickles me whenever I see a new one, and I want to thank everybody who's taken the time to do it. And I urge all of you to do it. If you haven't, and I know lots of people who tell me they listen to the show and they tell me about favorite moments and things like that, and I know they are actually listening, so why aren't they going to iTunes and leaving a nice review? That's what I want to know. That's what keeps me up at night. That's what keeps me tossing and turning. Why? I ask myself, why? But I know they're going to. I have faith in them. We're all part of the Brotherhood of Man, and this is how you can show your support of this brother, and I hope you do. Thanks to my wonderful wife, Claire, for being my announcer. Thanks to James Hutchins for designing my website, thecommentarytrack.com, and frankthompson.tv. Thanks, as always, to Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for writing our wonderful theme music that we love so much each week. And I want to give you a quick update on Lost Remake of Beaugest. All the material is at the DVD place. It seems to be working this time around. As you may remember, I told you I took it about now 3 weeks ago, and turned out there were huge technical problems that nobody had seen coming, and so it gave us another delay, and so it is back, and so far, so good. Keep your fingers crossed. So if we get the finished product this week, it'll be in the mail to all the people who need to get copies, and it'll be available to all the people who want to buy copies, and I hope that each and every one of you buys at least 70 copies. I think that's the least you can do. You all have 69 friends you could send copies to. Keep one for yourself. That's a good plan. So, I hope you enjoyed this time. Next week, we'll be with my friend, author and film historian, Jordan Young. We had a great conversation yesterday, and we talked character actors, and we talked Spike Jonze a little bit. Not as much as we need to, so I got to do another one with Jordan just about Spike Jonze. But a lot of good movie talk, and Jordan is the only person I've ever known who interviewed both Burt Mustin and John Lennon.
And that says something important about him. So that's coming up next week. And in the meantime, don't you worry. We'll fix it in post.